haunting emotions of this desperate place were suffocating her. 10. Torment. The creature flung itself against the stone wall, all four paws raking and clawing. The demon beast's devastating hooked claws dug deep gashes into the stone and held the fossa aloft on the vertical surface for many heartbeats. Cat-like, the beast leaped away, clunking down and scuttling about on the bone pile that floored its smelly den. So many bones. Human, bear, lion, deer. It didn't matter. If a creature lived free of torment and crossed the angry fossa's path, that creature would be destroyed. It had to be destroyed. But mostly the humans. Yes, the humans. They were the ones who pulled the crystals from the mountain. They were the ones who gave maddening voice to the magical flecks of gem and mineral. And that voice, that song, drove the fossa mad. Particularly so on nights such as this. Those about the mountain would see the red moon lifting from the eastern horizon, but the fossa could feel it, could hear it. The blood moon called out to the beast, summoning it to the hunt. The old memories of the fossa, before it came to hear the discordant and maddening song of the crystals, tried to resist, tried to fight back against the call to murder. The creature flung itself against the wall once more. Claws dug deep gashes, cutting the stone, sending flecks flying to rattle into the bone pile. Against the wall, the creature could hear the song, humming from deep within Fyroxpuer, from the subterranean crystal garden near the mountain's summit. And that song drove it to heightened fury, the claws scratching furiously. The fossa hated the song. And yet that was what sustained it. Without that magic, the creature would have died long ago. Somewhere deep inside its animal brain, the fossa understood that truth, and it only made the demon beast hate the magical song of Fyroxpuer even more. Better to be non-existent than this madness. The beast fell to the bone pile, its scythe-like tail swiping through, throwing leg and arm and bones about, and crunching through the ribcage of a long-dead victim. The fossa thrashed, launching bones all about, flinging them up to the walls of the pit it called home, and caring not at all when they crashed back down upon its own head. Not content with its tantrum, the fossa clawed and grasped the largest bone it could find, the thigh of a great brown bear, and gnawed at it with all its might, biting right through in short order. It sensed the red glow of the moon, and it was a call the fossa could not ignore. Hating its very existence, hating the magical song, hating everything alive, the fossa leapt straight up, clearing the 20 feet of the pit with ease and grasping at the sloping stone of the lone tunnel, the singular exit from the secret mountain cavern. Claws dug in, and the fossa pulled itself along, low to the ground, and through an opening barely wide enough for it to squeeze through. Growling and snorting, the creature dug along, coming to a wider opening, and a drop to a larger tunnel. The aroma of the death pit filled the lightless air even out here, and the fossa breathed deeply, reveling in it, thinking it sweet. A few moments later, the fossa leaped over a boulder and through a small opening to emerge into the open air, the nighttime air of Fyroxpuer, and with the red moon beginning its climb up the eastern sky. On padded paws, claws retracted, the fossa stalked off, sniffing for the stench of life, human or animal. It didn't matter. Just something to kill. And with every stride, the fossa listened for the song of magic, and hoped in its black heart that it would find the human singing it. That would be the sweetest kill of all. The beast charged through some trees to a cliff face, and leaped straight up 30 feet to the ledge above. 3 more strides, and the fossa sprang far and high over a ravine, landing silently, sprinting off, but then skidding to a sudden stop, its hairless, scarred face coming up and swinging about. Ears twitched, and the fossa curled the remaining half of its upper lips, showing gleaming fangs, its few whiskers, remnants of another existence, feeling the night wind, measuring the scent against the currents, honing in. Then it was off at a blistering pace, springing up the side of a tree, leaping far to land lightly upon a large boulder, where its supernatural claws dug in and froze it in place, to pivot and spring off to the side. The fossa could outrun anything on the mountain with ease, and it was so quick with its forelegs that it could change angles over a berm or fallen log without the slightest of hops, keeping its back smooth and straight and fast across broken ground, even small ravines. The scent grew stronger, driving the hungry creature on. It noted the flicker of white, the tail of a deer, and veered, buzzing through the brush, singularly focused. A short distance ahead, the deer leaped a ravine and turned down the descending mountain trail around a high outcropping. The fossa went up instead, leaping godlike to the top of the outcropping, thinking to fly down from on high to bury into the deer on the other side. And indeed it spotted the animal and stumped down its rear legs for the springing kill. But then the creature's snarl dissipated, and its expression changed as its head came up, turning to the sky, to the southern sky, for there, splayed across the starry sky, lay the halo, the planetary ring of the world of Corona, glowing softly across the spectrum of colors, a great rainbow encircling the whole of the world. The fossa could not ignore its call, for this ring, full of gemstones and minerals, was the magical god of Corona, the antithesis, the mortal enemy of the demonic magic that gave the fossa immortality. The ring gave this world its name. The ring of Corona fed the magical gemstones to the world, the blessed items that had birthed a religion in the East, that bolstered the power of kings and given monks the ability to produce fireballs and lightning bolts, even to fly. In more ancient times, the Ring of Corona had scattered across the world its seeds of magic, like those that had grown to become the crystal cave of Firoxboer. The demon fossa knew all of this, and knew most of all that this ring taunted, that the magic of this ring threatened. The demon fossa was death. The Ring of Corona was life. Far below, the deer was long gone, leaping and springing along the slopes of the huge mountain. The fossa did not try to spot it among the lower slopes, or to regain its scent. No, the demon beast stood there, and stared at its nemesis. It flexed its claws, digging them into the stone as easily as a man might clench his fist in the sand. The lip curled again, and a long and low roar came forth, rolling through the mountain valleys, echoing off hard stone walls, carried on the night breezes all the way down the mountain, where the villagers of the 7 tribes took note. All about that high outcropping, deer fled, bears scrambled aside, leopards sped away, and small animals crouched deeper in their burrows. They all knew. They all understood that the moon was red, and death itself had ventured out onto the slopes of Firoxboer. For a long while, the fossa sat there, growling at the glow of the planetary ring. Finally, it turned away, and plodded off around the mountainside, but no longer looking for something to kill, its appetite stolen by the sight of the awful ring. Now the creature was more interested in defying the energy that gave life to the world of Corona. It turned and stalked for a high crevice, a gorge from which flowed the magic of the mountain. A place the Uskar called Kreasadiat, the mouth of God. 11. Staring into Hell. Aulan sat in the tree in the sacred grove, the same tree, the same spot, where she had first viewed the crystal obelisk, the physical manifestation of Uskar, more than a dozen years previous. She remembered that long-ago day, when the warriors had returned from their lakeside raids. That was the first day she had seen Thump's mother. Badlan, she corrected herself aloud. His name was Badlan, not Thump. The helpful and friendly little boy deserved a better name than Thump. Aulan had returned to this grove only a handful of times over the years, and not at all in the last couple. She was older now, and coming here was forbidden, and she knew that the consequences of being caught here could be dire. There were whispers that she would one day become a witch of the coven, and though she didn't understand all that such a position entailed, if it brought her closer to magic, to the crystals and the crystal god, it would, she thought, be a very good thing. Better that than stepping on pine cones like a serving girl, or bending over to the demands of a warrior husband, who probably hated her as much as he loved her, who sated his carnal desires with slave women whenever he so chose. She winced, and tried to put it all out of mind. Too many bad things swirled in her head this night. "Better to be a witch," she whispered. Yet here she was, where she didn't belong, and being caught here could jeopardize all of that. But she didn't move, didn't leave. For where was she to go? Far to the west before her, long from the slopes of Firoxboer, the huge moon, tinted bloody red, rode low to the horizon, the lines of moonlight streaming across Lochbjug's wind-stirred water, casting sparkles. Aulan locked her gaze on that mesmerizing dance, trying to use the mystical night light to remove the images from her mind. To no avail. She saw Badlan's mother, the warrior rutting atop her. The woman's eyes stared at her, helpless and hollow, as if her soul had long ago departed, and only her body remained. And only remained for the sake of the boy. That image had chased Aulan from the thick boughs of the slave encampment. Haunting her, those eyes had chased Aulan right past the tribe's proper encampment, running and scrambling, hands to the ground on the steep slope before her, up the side of the mountain, up to the winter plateau, and to this grove just beyond. And to this tree, to a place of her past, that she could hide from the present. But she could not. She brought her gaze in closer, to the bank of the nearest lake, to the foothills of the mountain. Her gaze roved up the mountainside. Far below her she could see the low-burning fires of the Uskar camp. The distance surprised her. She must have run and clawed up the mountainside for half the night. When first she had arrived here, in the tree, she had looked back, expecting to see torches moving out from the Uskar camp, or perhaps the magical light of enchanted crystals, as Shona and others went out in search of her. For a long while she searched the darkness below, and for a long while she wondered why they were not looking for her. Then the moon dipped low enough before her to demand her attention. The full moon, hanging red in the sky, the red face of Issibol. The blood moon. The fossa moon. The enormity of her journey had struck Aulan hard. She could not deny the unusual moon, wonderfully round and seeming flush with blood. The demon would be hunting. Good fortune alone had kept her path separate from that of the demon beast. Or had it? She told herself that the creature wasn't real, reminded herself that the fossa was a fairy tale meant to scare the children of the tribe. That had been her opinion, at least. But out here alone, under the blood moon, That opinion so suddenly seemed rather thin to Alan. The thought unnerved her, and she scanned all the area around her. Surely the fossa couldn't come here, so near the crystal god, she whispered to herself unconvincingly. She scanned back down to the encampment, to the central bonfire that had blazed this night, but now burned low. The fire, of course. The night was warm, and they needed no fire. But the moon was full, the blood moon, and so the fire would keep the beast at bay. Aulan, in her foolish anger, had let that thought, had let all thoughts slip past. She felt the eyes of Badlan's mother chasing her from the pine grove, and so she had to run. Nothing had mattered except that she escaped that place, the Uma's boughs, and the camp of the horrible people who would keep such slaves. And of course there would be no one looking for her, for none but Aulan were foolish enough to be out of the camp under the light of the blood moon. She clutched the tree tighter, her gaze locked on the distant, dying bonfire. This grove had always called to her, had always provided her comfort, a warmth in her chest near her heart. She had never told Shona or any of the other women of the coven about that warmth, but when Shona talked of the magic of the tribe, it often started with descriptions of a woman's center, her soul, a line of life from the hair atop her head to the hairs of her pubis. This line of life energy seemed stronger to Aulan when she was here, in this place, in sight of Uskar. She needed to remember that now, for after looking into the eyes of Badlan's mother, Aulan had come to sense a pit of darkness beside that line of life force, a place of despair and emptiness, a place of living death. So Aulan had hoped that the warmth of the crystal god would drive that emptiness away, and had run here. She thought to turn and glimpse the angled crystal obelisk, and wouldn't it be beautiful in the moonlight? But she found that she could not. She couldn't move her gaze. It wasn't the dying bonfire that held her, but rather the darkness beyond that one spot of light. The hairs on the back of her neck stood up and tingled. She felt the weight of a predator's calculating gaze. She couldn't move. Beyond Lochbeag, the huge red moon touched the horizon. All would be dark soon, until the pre-dawn glow found its way around the Black Mountain. And something dangerous was near, and Aulan probably wouldn't even see its face until she knew death. Look, she told herself breathlessly, trying to find her courage. She felt the chill as the night breeze tickled her sweat-covered skin. Sweat? She heard herself panting and thought it ridiculously, stupidly loud. She thought herself a fool. She thought herself a coward. Nay, she could not abide thinking herself a coward. She spun about suddenly toward the meadow encircled by the grove. She saw the physical manifestation of Uskar, quietly glowing in the red moonlight reflections. She lifted her eyes suddenly, reflexively, up the side of the mountain, to the higher spur beyond the Uma's caves, to the region where lay Kresadirth, the mouth of God. The ridge's black silhouette stood out starkly to her, blocking the many stars beyond. So clear, that silhouette. And so clear the black form that walked the high ridge. Low it moved, crouched perhaps, and long, and even from this distance, Aulan could tell that it was longer than a man was tall. Long and low, not quite feline, and more like a weasel, Aulan thought. A weasel, but huge. The black head swiveled, and a pair of eyes stared back at her. Red eyes. Red, not green like those of a cat, not yellow like those of the brown lizards Aulan used to chase about the mountain stones when she was a child. Red eyes, staring down at her from that distant ridge, too far away to see her, and yet they could see her, she knew. She just knew. It was real. The fossa was real. And as horrible as they had said, even so far away, the evil aura of the demon Childa. The creature moved slowly, still staring down at her, seeming to glide more than walk along the ridge. Then it was gone. Just gone, moving impossibly fast. And it took Owlin a few heartbeats to realize that the creature had gone over the ridge the other way, and not down into the darkness coming toward her. And then came the roar, long and low, a rumbling vibration that climbed right up the tree in which Owlin perched, and into her legs and through her body, a roar she felt as much as heard. A roar that said, "I see you." A roar like death itself, like the blackness in her belly beside her vibrant line of life. A roar that stole the sparkle from her eyes, and threatened to fill them with the same emptiness she had seen in the eyes of Badlan's mother. Owlin put her head against the tree. A tear rolled down her cheek, and she had to clutch the pine tighter to stop a rumble of sobs from shaking her shoulder. No, she would not cry. She forced her thoughts back to that day, years before, when first she had seen Badlan's mother. She had been so excited then. The raiders had returned, with slaves, and a pregnant woman, the ultimate capture, a blessing from Uskar, surely. Soon, though, that memory burned at her. She saw the woman born into the camp. She saw the woman in her bed, a man grunting atop her. She saw the anguish in the woman's eyes, not directed at the uninvited Owlin, nor even at the man raping her, but at her son, who entered the room, who saw what he should not have to see, because she, his mother, could not protect him. And she, Owlin, was too feeble to help. The pit in her chest grew. Badlan's mother's face, her anguished eyes, would not leave Owlin's thoughts. And the pit grew, and it consumed her center, and the spiritual warmth of the sacred grove was no match for it. Her breath came out in short gasps. Her anger rose. The image of the demon on the ridge was there in her mind, a final darkness, death itself, and she knew that she could not escape. But the beast had departed, she reminded herself, and the moon was nearly gone, and so the hunting night of the fossa would end. A low and feral growl escaped Owlin's lips. She would climb down the tree and run down the mountainside to the camp and wake Shona from her sleep and confront the older woman about how wrong all this was. She would tell Shona of the wrongness of the look in the eyes of Badlan's mother, and oh, how could the Uskar put that look into the eyes of any woman? The practice was not godly. Nay, it was evil. It could not stand. And Owlin would fight Shona if she needed to, or even the whole tribe. And she would win, and she was a 16-year-old girl. She did not move. The moon set and the stars shone brighter. And a mystical glow shifting through the spectrum of colors caught her attention, down the mountainside and to the southwest. She didn't want to move, but she couldn't resist. And so she leaned forward in the tree, straining to see past a lower mountain spur, trying to see the source. The halo of Corona. Deonon to the Uskar tribe. Eternity. Wherein sat Korsaleog, the place of spiritual reward to those loyal to the true God. Owlin had seen the glow of Deonon before, but never like this. Never before the actual source of the glow. Was this a gift from Uskar to her, to counter the dark pit in her soul that so haunted her, a reminder of better possibilities than the dark fates she had witnessed so clearly? She stared long and hard at Deonon, and felt connected to it suddenly, as if this place, the sacred grove of Uskar, was truly amplifying the beauty of the heavenly display. She thought to climb down and cross around the western rim of the mountain to gain a better vantage, but held her place, transfixed. For a brief moment, Aulan knew relief. But the high clouds drifted past, and Deonan diminished, and seemed so very far away. There was no hiding there. Not now. And the red eyes and the dead eyes were there again in her thoughts, staring at the emptiness within her, terrifying her, holding her. She shifted back, hugging the sappy trunk, and there she remained until the pre-dawn light ebbed about Firoxbuer, and the mountainside awoke around her. Still she did not move, not even when morning came. Ineva rested back in the dark in a rare moment of peace. She couldn't see anything, for the moon had long set, and the boughs of her home, made of nothing but pine branches and dirt, had no other source of light. But she turned her head to the left, toward the interlocking branches of the two pines that separated her small shelter from that of her son. The boy, the daemon, called Thump. Ineva was proud of him. He had heard her words through the years, and convincingly played the role she had given him. He was Thump. He was stupid to any but those who looked most closely. That was the only way her son could live past his change to young adulthood, Ineva knew. He couldn't become recognized as a threat to the daemon, or they would torture and murder him most horribly. But was it a fool's errand? Surely one day the daemon Uskar would realize the truth of Thump. Ineva had only delayed the inevitable. The woman sobbed, thinking, not for the first time, that she should have smothered her son when he was a baby. Her own cowardice affronted her. She sensed movement to her right and spun about. "Ineva," came a soft whisper, and she knew the voice. And she reached her arms out to invite an embrace that she sorely needed at that dark moment. "Anise," she whispered back, and she hugged the woman closely and ran her hands about, feeling the two large bumps on Anise's head. Anise was half Ineva's age, nearing 20, and had watched her brother sacrificed several years earlier. She wasn't from Fossochcran, but from Selad Tulloch, the northernmost of the lakeside villages, perched in the nook of two mountains, with trails and houses running up to the crest of a deep drop overlooking the black sands and stones of Fasail Dovclach, far below. In their normal lives, in their respective villages, Ineva and Anise would not likely have been friends, let alone shared such a supportive embrace. Rare were the interactions between the folk of their villages, and usually they only occurred out on the lake, on boats battling over a favored fishing spot. Up here, though, in the clutches of Uskar, they had each other, and little more. "Why are you so sad this night?" Anise asked. At first Ineva thought it an odd question. When was she not sad? When were any of them not miserable? But Ineva couldn't deny the question or the reasoning behind it. Yes, they were always sad, but rarely sobbing. Those who had survived the Uskar for years, particularly the women, had long ago lost their tears to an awful, hollow emptiness. This night was one of the rare times when the suffering became too much for emptiness and emotional distance alone. "My son saw," Ineva whispered. Anissa's sigh told her that she didn't have to elaborate. Every Umas woman knew exactly what there was to see. "He is strong," the younger woman offered. "He will find a way through his pain." "He's just a child," Ineva protested. "He should not have seen. I do not want him in such pain." "Pain is all we can know," said Anise. Ineva hugged her tighter. There was no way to honestly disagree. She should have smothered her baby those many years ago, she thought again, and not for the last time. Aulan stirred from her sleep, the daylight beaming about her, the sun shining brightly above Fíorchspuir. It took her a moment to gather her thoughts, to realize that she was still in the pine, 10 feet from the ground, and far up the mountain from her people. Her back ached, and her eyes stung from the harsh light of morning so high up the mountain, but the worst was the ache in her chest, in her center. With great effort, she managed to extract herself from the hardening sap that grabbed at her. Haunted, she climbed down from the tree and headed back to the encampment. Many were about, but none paid her any heed as she moved straight across toward Shona's tent. She saw Badlan and his mother among a group of Umas clearing the ashes about the bonfire and gathering new kindling. There wouldn't be another blood moon this night, of course, but the Fossa's hunt often provoked reactions among the other denizens of Fíorchspuir. The she, or the great predators, or even a stampede of deer. Aulan kept her gaze to the flap of her teacher's abode, not wanting to lock gazes with Badlan, and certainly not with his mother. One of the slave guards, whip in hand, offered her a smile and a nod, and she just moved faster, needing to be away. These people didn't even realize that she had been out of the camp throughout the night, Aulan thought, and hoped. But those hopes were dashed the moment she moved into Shona's tent to find a glare of such intensity and anger that it took her breath away. Aulan shied from the older woman, but only for a heartbeat, reminding herself of the look in the eyes of Badlan's mother, reminding herself that this woman before her was complicit in that travesty. She stood straight and matched Shona's stare. Slowly, unblinking, without breaking eye contact for even an instant, Aulan crossed the tent to the wash basin. She turned away to wash away the dirt of the mountain, scooping lukewarm water from the basin with cupped hands. Before she could bring the water to her face, she felt a hand grasp the collar of her tunic, yanking her backward and spinning her about. She nearly fell, but caught herself at the last instant, straightening to face her assailant, just as Shona brought her hand around to issue a sharp backhand slap across Aulan's face. Aulan yelped, as much in surprise as in pain.
"You are to sleep in your own cot," Shona said, her voice flat and emotionless.
Aulan opened her mouth to respond, but Shona slapped her again. "I," the young woman stammered, and another smack snapped her head to the side.
"Were you with a man?"
Aulan stared at her blankly. "What? No," she answered. "No!" Shona stared down at her, clearly disbelieving.
"Who was it?" the woman asked.
Aulan shook her head, her expression sour.
"Then where were you?" Shona demanded. "I will ask others."
"None will answer," said Aulan.
Shona's face contorted, her eyes going wide, and she stiffened as if she meant to slap Aulan yet again.
"I was not in the camp," the young woman blurted.
"You stayed with the slaves," Shona shot back, horrified.
"In the grove."
"No," Aulan started to say, but she bit it back, considering her options.
"Not with the slaves, but I was in the grove, yes."
Shona studied her carefully.
"Are you lying to me, child?"
"No,"
Aulan said, and she straightened with some confidence, for it was not an untrue statement, even though it was obviously a deception.
"I was in the grove."
Shona didn't respond, didn't blink for a long while.
"There are magical ways to learn,"
she started to warn.
"Fetch the grey-flecked crystal if you need," Aulan invited, for she knew that the coven kept a certain crystal, thick with wedstones, which could be used to determine if someone was lying, though it was not overly reliable, Shona had taught her. Still, even if lies could be easily detected, clever Aulan figured she was safe enough, for in this case, "in the grove" wasn't an untrue statement, though surely Shona was thinking of one grove, the pines serving as the slave encampment, while Aulan had spent the night in another altogether.
Why would you stay with them? Shona asked suspiciously.
I didn't, Owlin answered. I mean, I was out and about. I just...
Out and about, Shona interrupted. You were out of the camp. On a night of Isabel's red face, you were out of the camp?
Shona rubbed her chin, her eyes flaring, and Owlin braced for another slap.
How can one as promising as Owlin be so truly stupid? Shona asked. And that stung more than a slap ever could. Do you know what the fossa would do to you?
It is danger-
Dangerous! Shona mocked.
She moved very close to Owlin's face, her eyes flaring with wild outrage. The reaction shocked Owlin with its intensity and its honesty. She knew the stories of the fossa, of course, but to see Shona so unhinged had her off balance indeed.
First, it would chew through your ankles, she said. So quickly. One bite!
She snapped her fingers against her thumb before Owlin's face, startling the girl and drawing a gasp of surprise.
How pretty would be Owlin's clever smile, I wonder, when you turned your head from the dirt to see your feet removed from your body. How confident your cry, I wonder, as the demon fossa dragged you away and took you to its lair to eat you. To slowly eat you, and you would live for a very long time, though you wish it not.
Owlin had nothing to reply, and so just stood there with her mouth hanging open, her black eyes rimmed with moisture, defeated.
You never go beyond the edge of the camp without my permission. Do you understand?
Yes, the girl, and truly she felt like a little girl at that moment, answered deferentially.
Shona snarled anyway. And when a task is assigned you, you are to do the task as given.
Owlin's expression changed in her surprise at the abrupt shift of the subject, and before she could stop herself, she shook her head, or started to, until Shona slapped her again, this time harder.
I filled the basket,
she whispered in reply.
I did as you commanded. Exactly as asked.
Her voice wavered as she replied, for now she was simply overwhelmed, sobs welling inside of her.
Exactly as commanded, Shona corrected her. I need not ask anything of you. You were told to take a numerous woman, and instead you took a child. A valuable child at that. You knew better. You knew that you should be helped by an adult, by one of the lake women. But still, you chose the child simply so that you could defy me.
Owlin started to respond, but held her tongue. She focused instead on what Shona had just said. A valuable child? Owlin did not understand. The boy seemed so feeble, mentally weak. What could possibly be valuable about him? She thought about asking Shona to explain, but reconsidered before her mouth began to move. She would ask Badlan himself later on. But no, she would not ask this harsh woman, and particularly not now, when Shona was so clearly angry, and when she was trembling with so many swirling emotions. And Shona was rightfully angry, Owlin knew in her heart, and not just because Owlin hadn't returned the previous night. Despite her protestations, her choice of Badlan had been intended to give offence. It was an act of defiance, as was her refusal to return to the camp the previous night. Well enough, she figured. She wanted Shona to be angry. She wasn't quite sure of exactly where she had found this focus, but it certainly had something to do with that pit in her chest. That anger she had felt when she had looked into the eyes of Badlan's mother. Owlin dropped her gaze to the floor, a gesture of submission, merely to placate Shona, but inwardly she smiled. Shona took her shoulder roughly and turned the girl toward the basin. Now wash yourself, child, she said, her voice still edged in anger, but holding something else Owlin could not identify. Concern, perhaps? Then we can begin the day's lessons. Owlin did as she was told.
She washed. She ate. She sat quietly and obediently for her lessons with Shona. Only occasionally did her thoughts drift away from the tasks at hand, her mind's eye again seeing the stairs, the red eyes, the dead eyes. So different, yet so alike, as if they were aiming for the dark place inside of her, but from different directions. The stare of Budlan's mother. The stare of the demon Fossa. 12. The Bells. It was the farthest east Talmadge had travelled in his life, so far that the mountains of the Barbican, which marked the western boundary of the Wilderlands, were behind him now, so far that he could ride to Ursel, the seat of power in the kingdom of Hans the Bear, in less than 2 weeks if he so chose. But he wouldn't choose to do that. He was in the region known as the Wilderlands now, though it was far more settled than that to which he was accustomed. His discomfort grew with every hamlet he spotted, a fact that wasn't lost on his travelling companion. "Sorry you followed me, eh?" Cote Tenzin asked, when they set camp atop a bald hillock one night, the lights of a distant village shining in the southeast. "I enjoy the company," Talmadge replied wryly. The statement was true enough. He had known Cote for 8 years now, since their meeting at Matigny, and it seemed like every passing year had them spending more and more time together, except for 2 years when their paths had not crossed. Talmadge did enjoy being around this woman, more than he ever expected. Her exotic looks, that strange cross between the pale Alpinadoran barbarians of the far north and the ruddy-skinned Togairu nomad of the high steppes, had not grown less attractive to the man. He had seen no one else quite like Cote in all his life and all his travels. Talmadge didn't think he'd ever get tired of hearing her tales of her years among the Togairu, with their strange ways and culture. And every year, Cote came back with new stories to perform. And perform she did, as well as any bard. "I think you just missed me last year. More than you'll e'er admit," Cote teased, for indeed the two had not met up at Matigny the previous year. "Can you say any less for yourself? I came here instead of remaining at Matigny at your insistence, yes? And I've lost the last month of winter and the whole of spring, and I'll lose the rest of the season just getting back to Matigny." Cote laughed at him. "If you're to ever shrink your world from Matigny to your mysterious lake in the mountains, you'll soon bore me," she said. "I don't like to be bored. Would that you might have joined me last year." Talmadge winced at the thought, torn now as he had been upon the invitation, for that invitation had been left open when he and Cote had parted ways after Matigny in the summer of 843. Cote had told him then that she meant to go to the east with the turn of 844, all the way to the Myrianic Ocean, to the great desert city of Jacintha, in search of her father. As much as he had come to enjoy Cote's company, the thought of entering a city of thousands and thousands of people terrified the man. "I know. I know, and I accept the truth of Talmadge," Cote said, as if reading his thoughts, and she waved her hand at him. "I am here, at least." The woman nodded and smiled widely. "You've been invited to visit Redshanks." "You were, not I. Mostly because he knew I could deliver you and your pearls," Cote said. "What woman or man roaming the wilds would refuse an invitation to dine at the house of Redshanks?" "True enough," he admitted. And he nodded, thinking that almost all at Matigny would lift their flagons in toast simply to learn that the legendary Redshanks was still alive, for the man had not attended the gathering in more than 5 years. "So no more of your complaining?" Talmadge held up his hands in defeat. Cote tilted her bowl, draining the last of her stew, then tossed the bowl aside, burped with surprising volume, drawing a complimentary nod from Talmadge, and crawled about the small fire to cuddle up next to the man.
She rested back in his arms, leaning back and forcing him back with her, that they could look up at the millions of stars twinkling this night.
"Tell me about the pirates," he bade her.
"No," she replied. "You tell me about strange-headed fisherfolk at your mysterious lake, and the demons of the mountain."
Talmadge snorted. "I have told you of them many times."
"Tell me again."
Talmadge knew where this was going. Several times over the years, Chote had asked to travel along with him for his yearly journey to Loch Bjug. On more than one occasion, Talmadge had almost given in and taken her along. But always, right before he would say yes, he remembered the Cloderch and the killing of Badger. Though now he mostly only remembered the gruesome sounds, the vicious lizard chewing at the corpse of the hanging man, tearing flesh and crunching bone, sounds that had chased Talmadge across the lake waters, all the way to Carr Sailach. As uncomfortable as Talmadge was in coming to villages like the one of his childhood, he was even more unnerved by the thought of having someone, anyone, accompany him to Loch Bjug ever again.
"Your father," he whispered. "You have not even finished your tale, and you speak of places I will never see."
"Then go and see them."
"Tell me."
Chote sighed loudly, and launched back into the story of her great adventure, crossing the desert of Beren to the great and exotic seaport of Jacintha. Talmadge closed his eyes, and let her words take him on that journey, and he fell asleep, dreaming of water that showed no far bank, and of great sailing ships. He even heard the bells of one ship calling out, four notes repeating, ding-dang, ding-dang, in celebratory cadence. But no, not ship bells, church bells, like the one of Talmadge's town, though he remembered them not in such exuberance, but in the low tonal peals of death. The man's eyes popped open, to find that the stars were gone, replaced by the glow of pre-dawn, to find that he was not dreaming dreams inspired by Chote's tale. The bells were really ringing, in this time and in this place, or at least in the village not so far away. Talmadge sat up, taking care, unsuccessfully, to not stir Chote.
"What is it?"
she asked before she had even opened her eyes. Talmadge stood, hands on hips, staring at the distant structures.
"I know not."
For all that he tried, he couldn't get the last time he had heard the toll of church bells out of his head. Chote was up beside him.
"Well, let's go find out," she said,
and started for the horses. But Talmadge caught her by the arm and held her back, and when she turned, her expression grew curious.
"What is it?"
she asked, but he didn't answer, and just continued to stare at the distant village.
"Talmadge?" she asked, confused.
But he had told her of his hometown of Westhaven, and the tragedy of the Rosy Plague, and the bells tolling for his family, chasing him out of town.
"That is not a funeral peal," Chote said emphatically,
and she grabbed Talmadge by the arm and forced him to look at her.
"Those are bells of celebration."
Her stare, more than her words, broke the spell, and Talmadge blinked repeatedly then as she repeated her statement. They packed up their camp, saddled the horses they had bought from a stable on the western edge of the Wilderlands, and walked down to Appleby in Wilderland, the village that served as home to the famed frontiersman, Redshanks. They found the town wide awake, with people dancing in the streets, and the markets already bustling. The name Princess Gilseppany Ursel was shouted from balconies and rooftops.
"So that's it, then,"
Chote remarked, as they walked their horses along the cobblestone streets of Appleby in Wilderland, following directions townsfolk eagerly offered, toward the home of Redshanks.
"Hans has itself a new heir."
Talmadge shrugged, hardly caring. And why should he? Even in his childhood, his family had never considered themselves part of this kingdom, and indeed had, generations before, headed out to settle in an area where they need not worry of kings and lords and armies trampling peasants underfoot.
Well, they seem to care,
Cote returned with a snicker. Do you have kings in Togai?
Warlords,
she repeated.
We are nomads.
Always at war? She shook her head.
War with the steppes, and the vipers, and the lions, and the roaring winds, yes.
War with each other, not so much. So what do the warlords do? Talmadge asked.
They lead the migrations,
Cote explained. They determine the scouts, and guide us in pursuit of the herds. And when we come upon another tribe, they speak for us, that we can determine the hunting grounds. And what do they exact in payment from their people, these warlords? Cote looked at him as if she did not understand, and Talmadge smiled, for that was all the answer he needed.
Your warlords are very different from the lords of Hans, I believe.
Cote didn't pursue the reasoning.
Neither matter to us, she agreed.
They were at the porch of a log cabin then, solidly built and larger than most of the other homes in Appleby and Wilderland. Before they had even dismounted, Redshanks opened the door and held his arms out wide and high in invitation.
Ah, butcher late, he said. Every day before this, I've been putting out extra plates and cooking a dozen eggs. I'm blaming you for this.
He rubbed his now ample belly, jiggling the extra girth. Couldn't be letting them go to waste, you know. Cote ran to give him a hug, and he moved gingerly toward her. He looked good, Talmadge thought, though he noted a distinct stiffness and limp in the old hunter's step. He kept an eye on that as Redshanks led them into the house and the breakfast table, and understood then why the man hadn't been going to Matinee. And sadly, why he likely would never do so again. It became obvious to Talmadge that Redshanks' days of wandering the wilderness were long behind him. He had kept his smile and kept his spirits high, as he and Cote began trading stories of the last few years. But the man had aged. Talmadge offered to cook the breakfast as the two continued their storytelling. There was a great bond here between these two. Soon he was only half listening, his thoughts turning to the unlikely journey that had brought him this far to the east, and uncomfortably close to the kingdom of Hans the Bear. Suddenly something Cote was saying caught his ear.
And you are now under the watchful eye of a new king yet again?
Not so new, Redshanks answered. Been 5 years since King Adrian made his departure at the end of an army of spears.
He was killed?
Cote asked.
Exiled. Taken by Gilsepani far from the lands of men, so it said.
Gilsepani? The new princess?
Named after her, but not of her blood, Redshanks explained. In her honor, and one she well earned by all accounts. 'Tis a long tale.
Redshanks shrugged as if it didn't matter.
It would seem that the squabbling is over. One king or another, what does it matter? Their arguments are over their own power, and with little regard to what any of us might want. It's always been so.
You came to live here, not I,
Cote pointedly reminded.
I followed opportunity more suited to a breaking body,
Redshanks said with a laugh.
It is always about business for Redshanks.
I have lived well, he reminded.
Talmadge brought the food to the table then, and took his seat opposite the legendary frontiersman.
I still do, Redshanks added.
Well enough, Talmadge asked.
More than that,
Redshanks answered through a mouthful of food. But you are not satisfied, said Talmadge. Cote put her hand on his forearm to try to turn him from this course. He did glance at her, but pressed on as he did.
If you were, you would not have asked us to visit. A favor for an old friend, perhaps,
Redshanks said.
Just that?
Talmadge asked doubtfully. Cote gasped a bit at that, but Redshanks took it as no insult, clearly, and laughed heartily.
Well, he admitted. You ken me too well, I fear.
But why? Talmadge bluntly asked.
Why? he answered. Opportunity. You just said you were living well. You have all that you could need. Why chase more? Redshanks laughed again. Ah, Talmud, you beautiful peasant, he said. Because it's there. Because it's exciting. Because when I stop chasing it, well, put me in the ground and throw dirt on me. Talmadge just shrugged and shook his head. If you give it a try, you'd come to see. I can show you the way. And might that you'd find a bit more smiles on that dour face of yours if you followed that trail.
Talmadge leaned back in his seat and studied the man.
You've the pearls, Redshanks asked Cutty.
Just a few.
Bah!
Not a good year on the lake, Talmadge lied. For it had been better than he had let on to Cote when she had told him of Redshank's invitation.
He had seen too much of the ways of the frontiersman to let on about the wealth he carried so far to the east, down overgrown trails, rife with highwaymen, where whispers moved faster than horses.
Redshank sighed and leaned back.
Perhaps a year too soon, then, he said. I still have many arrangements to make.
What arrangements? Talmadge asked.
What are you trying to do? Right to the point, eh?
Redshanks replied with a grin.
I like that. You've seen me walk. I doubt I'll e'er cross the Masar Delaval again.
Talmadge looked to Cote, not understanding.
The river separating the more civilized lands, Redshanks explained. Your pearls bring in a great price in the city of Palmaris, on the eastern bank of the Delaval.
And you want me to go there?
They're your pearls and my buyers, said Redshanks. The fewer people I put in between those truths, the more for me and you.
I have enough.
There's never enough.
Why?
Because more is life. Excitement. Enjoyment. You've this beautiful woman by your side. Oh, I know her charms and her skill. Would you not build a life of excitement and enrichment together?
Talmadge understood at that moment that he and Redshanks would never agree on what those words, excitement and enrichment, might mean. He said nothing, but let the man continue to explain the network he was setting up to funnel the goods more efficiently to this city of Palmaris and beyond. Talmadge took note of Cote and saw her genuine interest. He could accommodate that interest, he believed, without having to journey to these places. The three spoke into the afternoon, then went outside and joined in the celebration for Princess Gilsepony. Cote and Talmadge stayed with Redshanks that night, but surprisingly, to both their host and Cote, that single day was as long a delay as Talmadge would suffer. Lochbeag, his yearly respite, was calling to him, and he had many hundreds of miles to cover to get there before snow covered the mountain trails. Talmadge made a deal with Redshanks for the pearls he had brought, and even threw in a few for free in appreciation for the man's good intentions. He even agreed to return to Appleby in Wilderland in the next year or so, to perhaps take Redshank's plans further, though he made it clear that he would not be the courier.
"We'll see," was all Redshanks would say to that, and slyly, and with a look to Cote. Many times did Redshanks try to convince Talmadge to remain a bit longer, but the man would hear none of it, and he and Cote were on the road back to the west soon after an early breakfast the next day. The Barbican mountain range was far behind the couple when they came to a fork in the trail, one going northwest toward a distant river, the other southwest toward the Matinee. They were more than 2 weeks out from Appleby and Wilderland, and had made fine time, although it was well into summer now, and the Matinee remained a journey of more than a week, likely more since the land was getting rougher and the going slower. Cote turned her horse down that southwestern trail, but Talmadge surprisingly dismounted and began pulling his packs from his mount.
"Too early to camp," she remarked.
"My road is north, to the river," Talmadge explained,
I've no reason to return to Matinee this season. You'll ride the river to your secret mountain lake.
Talmadge smiled at her.
Chote dismounted.